Hi, Happy New Year to all our listeners, and welcome to episode 36 of Attention Please, right here on Talking Stuff Network. We are recording this, of course, on New Year's Day, 14th of April. By the time many of you listen to this, winter very well might have come. And while we don't have Khaleesi, we do have our host Arnab with us. So, Happy New Year, Arnab. My brother's in Minnesota right now with 7 feet of snow. So, winter apparently never went away for him. But any thoughts on the Game of Thrones season coming up?
Well, it's been, first of all, Shubho Navabarsho to all my listeners. It's been how many years? 9 years? 10 years? And whenever something goes on for this long, like the UPA government, there is some amount of lethargy. You know, it's almost like I have to see what happens, but I'm not excited anymore. I don't know if I'm the only person who's feeling this. It's just dragged on for too long. And there is, I just don't see how the writers are going to give us a memorable ending. I just feel that the number of mediocre endings, the sheer probability that it will be very mediocre, is just so much higher than it will be exceptional. I just cannot think of how, and ultimately, in a way, this is inevitable. Maybe I've discussed this on the podcast before, but if I haven't, then you see, the unique thing about Game of Thrones, at least the novels, it's not so much the TV series, but the novels are that it's a very unique style of storytelling that George R.R. Martin uses. It's not a plot-driven narrative in the way, let's say, Harry Potter is, because it's very dense with plot. Things are happening all the time. And J.K. Rowling is moving characters to get from one plot point to another. So it's very dense plot-wise. It's brilliantly plotted, the Harry Potter series. And that's really been the conventional way of writing stories. So about, I don't know, 95% of the books you've ever read, which are fiction, are that. They're story-driven. They have a very definite beginning, middle, and end. Now, with George R.R. Martin, there is no beginning, there is no middle, and that's why the problem is there is also no end. So what he's done, and that's really been the unique thing about the experiment of what Game of Thrones is he's less focused on building a story and more focused on building a world, a universe. So what he does is, there is no really central story. He basically creates a lot of very compelling characters. And what makes Game of Thrones so unique is, it's rather than the story, you feel invested in the characters. You feel invested in Tyrion. You feel invested in the Lannisters. It's not so much the story that they have, but the character arcs. So to look at Game of Thrones, it's really, think of it as a massive graph with a lot of character arcs. And they have intersection points where the two curves meet, and then they diverge again. So for 9 seasons, that's essentially it. It's just a series of very complicated curves on graph paper. And while that's very fascinating, as the journey goes on, it's very difficult to kind of converge this mega mathematical series into this one fixed point, which will be satisfying to all. It's virtually impossible. I would be pleasantly surprised if they were able to do it, but I would say I'm pretty sure that they will not be. It's just that the nature of Game of Thrones is that it is not supposed to converge. It is supposed to go on as a world does. So, of course, there will be some characters who will be killed. And I think it's fairly, at least it should be obvious to many as to who they will be. Like, who is not going to come out the other end alive. And I'll give you a hint. One of them is definitely is Jaime Lannister. I have been betting that he's going to be killed off for the last 3 seasons. And somehow, amazingly, he's managed to survive. So he's definitely not going to make it out alive. But ultimately, it's just like who lives at the end and who dies. That's really what is left in Game of Thrones. I don't think there will be a satisfying resolution to the story. And again, I would love.
Did you watch? Were you a fan of Lost?
I was a fan of Lost. Well, I watched Lost after it was over.
Same here.
And the problem with Lost was that Lost was lazy writing. So it builds a very intriguing premises in the first season and the second season, and somewhere down the line they decide, oh my goodness, we've just made too many
exactly
things which we cannot resolve.
So let's just not even bother resolving them. Let's just throw in another thing very late into the game. And that's, again, one of the problems with writing multi-season or multi-book sagas. You will see the same problem in J.K. Rowling. So the Deathly Hallows, that whole concept, comes very late into the whole, if you look at the saga, it comes very late. It comes in the last two books. Not even perhaps in the last two books, in the last book. So, and that kind of totally changes everything. And this happens because obviously an author, when he starts or when she writes the first book, they're not looking at success. They're not planning for success. They're not thinking that this will become a 7-8 book series. So they have a very restricted focus. And then somewhere down the line, they become obliged by the pressure of fans to kind of come up with something great. And I think that that's really what Game of Thrones is going to suffer from. In a way, George Martin has stopped writing the books. So I think that should tell you something, that he himself cannot resolve it, given what he has done. And the TV series has deviated sharply from the books.
Right, from last season.
So itself. I honestly think that for two or three seasons, I honestly don't think that Winds of Winter is ever going to come out. And I mean, I just don't think it's going to happen. There's a reason why it hasn't come out for so long, because the story, the series there, when I say series, I mean the mathematical series, is so diverged from what it is in the TV series. The TV series has kind of been a little bit more conventional. They have tried to keep the focus on plot, and that's important, because you cannot have a TV series where people just wander around walking and singing and things meander on for 300, 400 pages. So you cannot do that because of the sheer amount of budget that's involved. So it's been much tighter. But I think, as I said, I just don't think that they're going to be able to resolve it in a way that at least a significant... I don't think you never can resolve anything in a way that everybody is as happy. But I don't think that they have... They never had an end game in mind when they started writing the story. And I think that will tell when it ultimately comes to the end. There will be
not to pull this part too much, but since you said end game, we do have that coming to an end as well next week.
See, that end game is a much more planned thing, because you see, there's never been a book, and this is not something which has been written by a single author. It has been written
by a committee
of writers who are not just looking at a story from a story perspective, but they're looking at rights, merchandising. They're looking at essentially creating a commercial behemoth. So in that case, again, it is not some guy like George R. Martin kind of having a literary experiment. So I am more confident. I think that some of the aspects of Endgame have been thought through for years. I don't think it's going to be tacked on at the end. I think the Miss Marvel thing was tacked on kind of late. I think in Endgame, you will find an absolute reference to... I think they show it in the trailer when one of the characters ask, where were you for
exactly.
so long?
It seemed tacked on.
So when he's saying that, he's basically articulating a common sentiment that if somebody is this powerful, why didn't we see her from day one with the Avengers itself? And I think that is the one that's been tacked on at the end. But the advantage that Marvel has is they can go back to some of the actual story arcs that have... So Thanos isn't a creation of this movie. There are comics on about Thanos, and you know, in they don't show that here, but Thanos is basically doing this because he's in love with death, and death is a character there. They're obviously not going to go there. I don't think they're going to go there. But ultimately, they do have some kind of source material also to draw on. But they're in no way restricted by the source material or by the personality of the author who put it together. In this case, George R. Martin, as I have read somewhere, is not a very easy person to work with. So the show writers always have to take into account that the guy they're working with is a brand in himself. And nobody knows who's writing. Nobody knows the names of the people who are writing Endgame. So I think it's going to Avengers Endgame is... I have more hopes. I have higher hopes from Avengers Endgame than I have for Game of Thrones. And that's ironic.
So what do you have for us today as our main topic?
So today I'm going to, since it's election season, I'm going to talk about political leadership. I was planning to do an episode on leadership in general, where I was going to focus on different kinds of cricket captains and the kind of lessons you get on leadership as to what works and what doesn't. And we'll do that someday. But for today, I just want to focus on political leadership, and maybe I'll do that next episode or episode after next. But since this is election season and that's kind of been playing on all our minds, I thought, I mean, there is IPL, and IPL is playing on our minds too. But I thought that of the bigger dramas, we will stick to the elections for this episode.
So leadership, all of us, I think most of us at least, I can't say all of us, we work for someone else. We work in a company, we work for someone else. We don't have our own business, or we are not the leaders of our own business. So we always deal with leaders. Most of us call them managers. I think the term managers is, people don't want to call themselves as managers. I think people higher up in the organization like to call themselves as leaders. But we've all of us at least, we have had terrible leaders, we've had good leaders, we've had good managers, you know. So what exactly constitutes good and what exactly constitutes bad? And what kind of leadership lessons or what kind of leadership templates can we extract from the present political disposition? So before we start, let's look at a little bit about history. So India, when it became independent, it derived its leadership, it derived its culture of leadership from the independence struggle. So it was, and Mahatma Gandhi was alive for just a year after, essentially, not even a full year, after India became independent. But what we inherited as a culture of leadership was essentially the Gandhian form of leadership. And the Gandhian form of leadership, you're going to hear different things from historians, also known as fanboys of the Congress and Gandhi. But Gandhi was an extremely autocratic ruler of the Congress. Once he got control of the Congress, remember that before Gandhi got control of the Congress, one of the most powerful politicians in the Congress was Muhammad Ali Jinnah. And very soon, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who was actually, and this is a historic fact, and you know, of course, Advani made the point at the wrong place at the wrong time, was actually once upon a time an extremely secular politician. He hated the idea of religion in politics. He was specially opposed to mullahs. And it was Gandhi, actually, who through the Khilafat Andolan brought in the Muslim clergy into the Indian freedom struggle. He actually brought in religion into, and so when they say it was the RSS, no, it was actually Mahatma Gandhi who brought in religion into Indian politics. Again, this is not a point which Congress fanboys who masquerade as historians are going to tell you. But you can, I mean, it's public knowledge, they just don't say it like this. But another part of Gandhi's leadership style was that even though he technically always liked to show, the part one of it was that there would be a reticence for leadership. So Mahatma Gandhi always liked to say that he was not interested in leadership, except he very much was. He wasn't, and Jawaharlal Nehru, and the Nehru was a good facade for him to rule the Congress, because Nehru was absolutely devoted to Mahatma Gandhi. He was not devoted just because of from the goodness of his heart, but because he knew that his power came from Mahatma Gandhi, from the cult of Mahatma Gandhi. And it didn't really matter to the common people what the Congress's policies were or what their strategies were. The only thing that mattered, and I discussed this in my last, I've been saying this in my podcast for a long time, is that political mobilization and voting does not happen based on policies. It happens based on emotion. It's very much like love. You know, people cannot deconstruct why exactly they like someone. But in case of Mahatma Gandhi, a lot of people loved him. They loved him in a way, and his leadership stemmed from love. He used that love effectively as a way to control the Congress. Everybody knew. That's why he used to go on these strikes. Because whenever he didn't get his way with the Congress, he would say, okay, stop, I'm going to stop eating. And I'm going to die as a result. And he did that because he knew, in an age pre-social media, pre-television, that the fact that Mahatma Gandhi was
was fasting and that it would lead to his death would ultimately be the greatest pressure, and that no Congress operative would be able to stand up to it, because everybody knew that they didn't really matter. The only person who mattered was Mahatma Gandhi. And for those of you who like to, you know, look ahead as to see where I'm going with this, you're going to see that there's more than one connection between this and the way Modi now controls BJP. Is that Gandhi is the party. Gandhi, but he has some people who he, and again, in India, at least in those days, a person who was actually the leader was kind of looked down upon. We do that all the time. That's a very middle class thing. Oh, he wants power. But Gandhi's main thing was, I don't want power. But he was very powerful. That's the same kind of leadership model which was later on adopted by, in a very different context, by Bal Thackeray. Is that a person who really wants to get the respect of people needs to at least nominally show that he or she is not interested in power. It's the same trick that Sonia Gandhi pulls, by the way, to lesser success, because Sonia Gandhi is not Mahatma Gandhi, nor is she Bal Thackeray. But it's the same thing, this sort of facade, this sort of act that I'm not interested in taking power, which is absolutely not true. So this is the culture of power that India inherited on August 15, 1947. And then it was Nehru, another one of the historical lies that are often peddled about Nehru, was that he was a Democrat. He was hardly a Democrat. He belonged to, and of course, when we say he was hardly a Democrat, we mean Democrat as is defined in 2019. In those days, that was considered to be democracy. So in those days, we were not mature as a nation to even understand what democracy was. We were coming off being ruled by the British Empire. And what actually happened was power passed from the British to Indians. But Nehru was as big a monarch as one can ever think of. So his model of government was one of essentially a benevolent dictator. This was not just unique to India. There were a large number of people across the world in those days, whether it be Marshal Tito, whether it be Nasser in Egypt, all of whom Nehru considered as his personal friend, who were essentially ruling their countries in the same way. That they considered that the underlying assumption was, I am the adult in the room. I am the adult in the room. The rest of the people, if we left the government to them, they would kill each other or tear the country apart. So while being leader, there was also a notion of, I'm doing this for a greater cause. This is a kind of thing that people like the Nehrus of the world use to convince themselves that what they're doing is not for themselves or for their own glory, but because of the good of the country. So he was essentially a model of a benevolent dictator. And he could afford to be, because after Gandhi, he kind of inherited that mantle of the single most important personality in the country. People in Congress knew that it was either Nehru's way or the highway. Now, Nehru did not go on fasts, because Nehru knew that he did not command that level of loyalty that Gandhi did. He was smart enough to know that. But he also knew, so when people talk about Nehru as a Democrat, Nehru was a Democrat in which we parents are, you know, we like to pretend that we are democratic to our children. And we like to say, oh, what would you like to have for dinner today? We know what the answer is, right? So that we present people with false choices to show that we are democratic, but it's all part of the game. And with Nehru, that was the thing. And then after that, you know, Indira Gandhi took over, and it was the exact same model, except that Indira Gandhi ratcheted up to another level. She basically, it was not just a question of her being autocratic and every decision, every big decision coming to her, but it was also, and this happens when you are a leader for a long time, her leadership style was about people essentially debasing themselves in front of her. So I used to have these old issues of Illustrated Weekly in India Today. And this kind of betrays my age. But in those days, when a Congress chief minister would get elected, one of the rites of passage, what they would go and camp in Delhi. They would sit outside. So if there were rival contenders, each would set up camp outside, you know, in Delhi to meet Indira Gandhi. So the Indira Gandhi would decide. This was democracy? What are we talking about? But this was what Indian democracy was. So for those of you, those the wires and other places who call Modi autocratic and fascist, read your history, okay? So these chief ministers who were democratically elected, by the way, in their old states, would basically have to go and, for want of a better word, debase themselves in front of Indira Gandhi in different ways. And then Indira Gandhi would bless one of them. She would come out, show her face for 2 minutes, and she would bless this person, and this person would then become the chief minister.
So she was the original Amma, so to speak.
Yes. And again, you're absolutely right. So I was coming to that. So this style of leadership, the Indira Gandhi style of leadership, became the Indian leadership style, which was adopted by different regional satraps. Amma, Mayawati, Mamata Banerjee. There were only two different, there were two leadership structures which were different. One was the Communist Party of India and another was BJP. So let's first talk about the Communist Party of India. So the Communist Party of India was rather unique. And for many years, it was the single biggest rival to Congressism. Was the Communist Party of India. It's very difficult for you millennials, many of you might be listening, to understand how powerful the Communist Party of India was. And it was not just because they had a significant presence in Bengal and Kerala, but it was also because they were backed by an international communist organization. Because they were, Marxism is a global movement. So they were taking their cues. They were taking their leadership cues from Mao and from Brezhnev. So it was not just, few guys in impeccably starched white dhotis that Indira Gandhi was dealing with. Indira Gandhi was dealing with as her principal opposition, even though the Russians were technically on our side. But she was smart enough to know that they played both sides. So she was dealing with them as frenemies. And so their organization leadership was very different. Their leadership was much more decentralized. There were very few leaders in them. I mean, Jyoti Basu and all these guys, that was the problem with them, is that they kind of tried to go to, and that was their conflict with the party. That's why they always found themselves not very popular, but they wanted to go to the Indira Gandhi model. But the party, and this was, again, for those of you who remember, Jyoti Basu wanted to become the Prime Minister of India, but the party didn't let him. So the party was very, very powerful. It was not about the personality. It was party. It was about this collective group, which they called the Politburo, which took all the important decisions. And these decisions, mind you, were not independent. These decisions were guided by guidance coming from the mothership. So this was the way they did. So their leadership, they had a leadership from a corporate terms. This was the franchise leadership, but there was also corporate, which was sitting in Moscow. Or some people took their orders from Moscow and some people took their order from Beijing. Very unique, very funny it sounds, but that was the way it was. And their whole thing was, and even when they came to rule, corruption for them was exactly the way you labor union should work. So in the Congress, money flowed to the top. All the money flowed to the top. In the Marxist system, the money actually flowed to the bottom. So everybody got a part of the pie in proportion to their influence. This was the classic model of empowerment of workers in a mill. So based on your productivity, you would get a share of the pie. And this was actually what made the Communist Party such a potent power in Bengal, because this was one of the few places where they were able to put this structure into place, which basically made elections redundant because they were in the system. And the system, Mamata Banerjee, again, talked about this before. Mamata Banerjee basically flipped that and made all of them hers. But the system had been built up by the Marxists for 35 years, which was that everybody gets paid in proportion to the amount of value they provide. This was not the Congress model. The Congress model was that the brand ambassador, which is happens to be always somebody with the last name Gandhi, they sit at the head of the table and they get to call what people do. And there were a number of satellites who were around them, who basically knew that the only way they could wield power was by being backroom boys. And they had to be absolutely loyal to the Gandhi family. There were phases in the Congress history when people didn't want to do that. There was the famed battle that Indira Gandhi had after Jawaharlal Nehru's death with very powerful Congress satraps. Except they thought at that point of time that they could essentially coup out Indira Gandhi and take control of the Congress. But they couldn't, because the Nehru-Gandhi brand was that strong that they just could not swing it, even though they were very smart people. Later on, Narasimha Rao tried. Sitaram Kesari tried. They couldn't, because the Gandhi brand name, and I'm coming to that, the brand name is kind of deteriorated. It's not deteriorated so much because Rahul Gandhi is Rahul Gandhi. That's part of it. But it's just that, you know, the character of Indians have changed. We don't feel, you know, beholden to the Gandhi family for bringing us independence, because it's just been so many years. But there were people who were just felt for the first 30 years of our nation's independence that we owed it to them, because Gandhis and Nehrus and all of them conflated together brought us independence. I mean, that gratitude is kind of worn away. And some of it is, of course, because of Rahul Gandhi. But there was another third political way of doing things, which was the way Jansangh. And for Jansangh, it was the RSS provided the kind of strong ideological backbone that the Marxists provided for the CPM. So in that respect, they were very similar, that there were some people who were more on the side of the doctrine and some people who were more operations. And the RSS was doctrine and the operations was Jansangh, which later became BJP. However, their unique style of the BJP, which was essentially Vajpayee and Advani, was that they had two people who were almost equally powerful, and that allowed them to essentially have one person in a way acting as an alternate to the other person. It was not just one person in the way that Congress was. And it was also not just the two of them. I talked to an old hand in the media business who said that one of the things about the BJP versus Congress was that in Congress, the access was to specific people. But in BJP, the access was to essentially the entire decision-making body. They would just sit together and just decide on things. So the thing about BJP, and this was something, it was part of the culture that Advani and started from Vajpayee, was that about 10 or 15 people who were considered to be heavyweights were allowed to decide about important policy and strategic decisions, you know, who goes where, as kind of a committee. This is where all the Murali Manohar Joshis and all of them were part of this. This is why they feel so slighted nowadays, because that culture has totally changed. This was really the reason why they came into BJP. This was the cultural difference between the Congress and the BJP. It was not just an ideological difference. It was a difference in the very way the political party was structured. Then, of course, as history, you know, as time went by, you know, coming back to this whole autocratic structure. So Indira Gandhi got so high on her own supply that, you know, emergency happened, where she felt that she could do whatever she wanted and get away with it. Because of course, and there was a reason for her to think that, because there was really nobody else. And when that didn't work out, it kind of was the first time the Congress realized that, hey, and this was, again, think of the time. It's 1975, about, you know, 30 years after independence. So one generation who felt really, really beholden to them, kind of dying out at this point of time. So this was the first time they see that India has changed, that kind of one or two generations have already passed. And we can't just keep on cashing in that we got you independence forever. So that kind of brought the Congress down to slightly, and that was when Rajiv Gandhi came in. He brought in some, he took some of the, you know, he brought in some kind of support cast for him. And his relationship to them was similar to the one that Indira Gandhi had, but it was not so much dependent on this shows of loyalty and this absolute debasement. It was a little bit more in terms of collegial. So with respect to VP Singh, with respect to Arun Nehru, he was trying to bring in a different culture, which was more aligned with the way BJP was doing things. Yes, he was definitely the ruler. Yes, definitely he had the last name, but it doesn't mean that the other guys had to basically roll in the mud to show that, you know, that they were loyal. Over the ages, and again, with his death, the power passed on to Sonia Gandhi. And so it's Sonia Gandhi, it was a different leadership stance. I mean, she realized that the country will never accept her as a leader. So what her leadership thing was that to rule by cipher. So Manmohan Singh was that person who she could put in front as a way. And she also felt that the Gandhi family at that point, and they do have powerful enemies. The thing with being an absolute leader is that you make a lot of people really, really hate you. And, you know, when I'm talking about hatred, I'm not talking about just people who are trying to assassinate you. They're not that kind of political opponents, but people inside their own party. You know, they end up hating you. And I think with the experience with Narasimha Rao, I think who I believe was the best prime minister India ever had. The reason why he was the best prime minister that India ever had was that he was a guy who figured out that, you know, his relationship with Manmohan Singh was he actually used Manmohan Singh in the way that he should have been used. He made Manmohan Singh the finance minister. So he's basically told Manmohan Singh, you're a good economist, solve the economic problems. Don't worry about politics. I will do the politics. I will provide you political cover. You just do what needs to be done. In contrast with Sonia Gandhi, who put Manmohan Singh into politics so that he would take the political blame while she sat behind. See, that's the wrong way of doing things. That's a bad leader, because the leader is not even thinking of the party. The leader is thinking of herself and her son at that point of time, which is really what led to the Congress, atrophy of the Congress, and to what it has now become. It is precisely this form of backseat leadership that Sonia Gandhi came with that actually has led to the decline of the Congress. But let's go back to BJP. This is the more interesting story. So, unfortunately, in the early 2000s, it was this community style of leadership that led to BJP's losing the throne. Because it was very difficult for people to get passionate about 15 people. You just cannot, just like you cannot love more than one person, you cannot love 15 people. And with Advani, and it was never really clear because they were all kind of doing this leadership by consultation. The BJP wasn't standing for anything. There was no brand ambassador. There was no mascot. Yes, you know, they would put Vajpayee's face or Advani's face, but people did not have, after some time, an emotional connect with that person. In the way that they had an emotional connect with Indira Gandhi. They did. Despite her being an autocrat, till the day she died, you know, people actually wept when Indira Gandhi died. It's the same kind of relationship that people have with Amma and people like that. You know, there are some people, and we might not be able to understand them, who genuinely, genuinely love these people and feel that they are part of family. There was nobody in the BJP at that point of time. It was, you know, Who would you get passionate over? And that was when Modi started coming into the picture. See, Modi 2002 was, for good or bad, when people started hearing about Modi.
Just a moment. But yes. Even at the height of his popularity, Vajpayee never had this thing which you spoke about, right? Where people, maybe I might be wrong, but I know a lot of people who admired Vajpayee, but like you said, that passion towards Vajpayee was missing. Even when he passed away, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, because right? Vajpayee was, his appeal was almost intellectual. There was no story around him. See, there's always a story around the greatest Congress leaders. With Nehru, this guy brought us independence. With Indira Gandhi, it was the daughter of the guy who brought us independence and won the war against Pakistan. With Rajiv Gandhi, it was poor guy, his mother died. Everybody had a story. With Rahul Gandhi, unfortunately, the story became the village idiot. So that didn't help him. But with Advani, and see, that's why people vote for on emotion. Okay, and the thing about emotion is there needs to be a very, very simple story that your subconscious can get plugged into. There was really no story. NDA tried to do India Shining, which was again an intellectual appeal to the noose, as they say in Greek. But it was not, it didn't appeal to people. They lost miserably because, again, there was no person. Now, for all intellectuals, this is perhaps really why so many people hate democracy, because it's all about emotion. But that's true. That's just the nature of the world. So that emotion wasn't there. And one of the reasons why the emotion wasn't there was that the strategies of, because there were 15 people, there was always this, everybody acted as a check upon the other person's personality, which initially was by design, but it also meant that none of those people could emerge as that kind of emotional, as a kind of a leader that people gravitate towards, which was when Modi and then Amit Shah, who again, he knows he doesn't have the charisma of Modi, but he is secure enough to know that he doesn't need to. There needs to be only one person. And so from around middle of 2005 to what we have come today, the BJP has essentially become a party of Modi in the same way that Congress has became a party of Indira. And right now, the reason why the old guard in BJP are so frustrated is because their entire party has become the exact model of the party they hated all the time. It is now that kind of a party. Because, and I've been looking at some of the election, coverage, and wherever people go, I think this is a very common refrain. People say, you know what, we're not happy at the way BJP has performed, and you know, we showed it in the assembly elections, but we love Modi. You know, he's a good guy. I don't really care about who my MP is. Of course, he's no good. But you know, none of the parties, none of the MPs are any good. They're all crooks. But I like Modi. This is both a matter of great frustration for Modi's opponents, as well as a source of great delight for his supporters. Because in a way, he's that's really where his greatest, that's why at least he still has his chance. Because you know, leader like that is essentially, he's kind of like the Salman Khan of politics, in the sense that it's just his face. It doesn't matter what the story is, doesn't matter what the policy, doesn't matter who's opposite him, doesn't matter. It's him. He is the party. People vote, people feel that emotional connect to him. That is why his story, you know, the Chaiwala thing and Congress, is the biggest mistake they ever did, was to hit him on that. That was his biggest advantage. The fact that he was not privileged, that he was not. And every time Congress goes on Smriti Irani's degree, on Modi's Chaiwalaness, every time they hit, they do themselves a huge disservice by doing this. The main problem with Congress is they are seen as a party of elitists. And what do elitists do? They message. And most people in this country are not elitists, unfortunately for them. Other than people who go in the rarefied circles of Latians Delhi or Read the Wire, they are not elitists. So every time they make fun of, you know, Modi's clothes or Modi's, you know, overall, it's very obvious when these stand-up comics, what they're making fun of, you know, this Wah Modi Ji Wah and everything. They're making fun of his so-called crassness. And it's not the kind of gentle crassness that Lalu Yadav had. Lalu Yadav used to, he's one of the guys who could play his crassness. His crassness was purely for show. He knew what people expected him to do and he did it. He did it in a kind, nice, gentle way. And then he took the fodder from the cattle. But the thing with Modi is that unapologetic, aggressive, in-your-face thing about Modi, you know, that really, really appeals to the base in him. And that comes back to what the thing I'd written in my last post is, that they see themselves in him. Now, this might be, and many people would say, this is all smoke and mirrors. There's nothing common to Modi and the common Indian person. And we can debate that. But the fact is, for the person going to polls, he sees himself in Modi. And a lot of people see themselves in Mayawati also. And that's one of her appeals. A lot of people saw themselves in Amma. A lot of people see themselves in Mamata Banerjee. These are people who are leaders because people can get emotional about them. Rahul Gandhi, despite multiple attempts by sympathetic media, is never going to get there, which is why they went with his sister this time. Because they have realized that Rahul Gandhi is a lost cause. He cannot get people out to vote. He is best for... He's for the last 10 years, he's made himself the butt end of so many jokes that it's very difficult to think of him seriously. The only emotion that people feel on seeing Rahul Gandhi is laughter. They think of all his jokes. They think of all his missteps. That's all. That's how he's perceived. So what the Congress did, and this is a good move, was to bring a new face, the only new face they could bring, who has the same last name. And they're bringing her because she's basically a blank slate. So if her media image is built together with their sympathetic people in media, if they can properly strategize, they can build her up potentially they can build her up to be that emotional. That's why she looks like Indira Gandhi. She looks like Indira Gandhi. You would see that, you know, there are cheerleaders in the media saying she looks like Indira Gandhi. Why do they say that so many times? Because there are sufficient number of people still alive in this country for whom she could become that emotional surrogate for Indira Gandhi. Some people who would still vote for Indira Gandhi if she was on the ballot. That's what they're trying to do. They're not saying, oh, there's a reason why they're pointing out the similarity. Rahul Gandhi looks a lot like Rajiv Gandhi. They never say that, oh, he looks like Rajiv Gandhi, because Rajiv Gandhi never had, after the phase of, you know, of Indira Gandhi's death past, people didn't have any attachment to him. That's why they never make that point. Because the thing with political leadership is that ultimately it's not a question of, you know, what your policies are or how you run the party or how you piss people off. Ultimately, in an electoral system, it's just the guy who's just going to cast his vote. Does he seek some kind of kinship with you? Are you, you know, in the US, they say, are you a kind of person they want to have a beer with? So it's that relative, it's the ability to relate. And honestly speaking, that's the only thing which Trump had over Hillary Clinton, that he was, ironically, but for vast swaths of the US, a person who more people liked than Hillary Clinton. That's why I said that if anybody other than Hillary Clinton had run against him, he would have lost, because Hillary Clinton was basically the zero level of likability. Anybody would be more likable than her. And they decided to select that person who was the least likable. So it didn't really matter whether Hillary Clinton was a better candidate. She obviously was. There's no doubt about it. She had built up to this for all her life. She was very, very qualified, extremely intelligent person. It had all the background done, foreign policy. She had done everything that was needed. But again, people just did not, in the key states, feel that kinship with her. You know, kinship with person, with a person who's all her years, you know, that she's lived her life as a politician. With Trump, because of his television, as a television personality, because he was being beamed into people's homes, people felt that much more kinship with him, with his, you're fired. I mean, again, it all worked to his advantage. He did not come, even when in his TV personality, he was never a likable person. You know, his whole shtick was he's not a likable, he's an asshole, but he's a high-performing an asshole. That's what people wanted. And so that emotional connect doesn't always have to be that he's a nice guy. It's just a perception that he will be able to be a good leader, which may be true or not. In Trump's case, I would say it's not. But it's just the perception. And with Modi, it's been very, very similar. It's been, for the last few years, we have seen that the personality cult of around Modi has become strengthened. And this is no idle political strategy. This is a very definite and I would say rather successful political strategy. Of course, it has robbed many traditionalists in the BJP in the wrong way. And Modi realizes that. So Modi has essentially become, her leadership style has become exactly similar to Indira Gandhi. It is, he is the ruler. There is an Amit Shah. And he has created a very, very alternate structure within the BJP, which has very little to do with class, BJP classic, let me call it. It's a group of people who swear their allegiance to Modi and who really don't have any other base other than being associated with Modi. The General V.K. Singhs, the Smriti Iranis, they're not really on-the-ground politicians. They are the only last person who had some was in Modi's cabinet was Sushma Swaraj, who's not contesting anymore. So that's been... On the other hand, you will see that the Congress has kind of undergone a slight different in their leadership. Now, yes, the Gandhi family is still the front people, but they have been at least smart enough to realize that their golden age is gone. That while they can be used as a brand ambassador in the way Ronald McDonald is a brand ambassador for McDonald's, but they cannot claim to be the real rulers of the party anymore. That is why you see that the Congress now essentially... The backroom boys have now taken over. The Sindhias and the Pilots, those guys are the guys who are actually running the show. That video of, you know, Rahul Gandhi standing there kind of with deers in the headlight and all these people advising him to say something, that's actually really a visual representation of what leadership in the Congress nowadays is. It's very real. That is exactly the way it works. That's why when the assets come out, check out the assets of Mr. Nakul. You know, as I said in Mahabharata, Yudhishthir was the guy who told the truth. Bhim was the most powerful. Arjun was the most skilled, but in this age, it's Nakul who makes the most money. Check out Mr. Nakulnath, Kamal Nath's son's assets, as he's publicly declared. This is the source of power in the Congress today. It is this leadership, the smart people in the Congress, the smart people that still remain, the Kamal Naths, who actually hold the power. So this has kind of been a reversal. Congress has now become the BJP kind of organization, and BJP has become the Congress kind of organization. And it stems from the personality of their leaders. So this is it for today. In the next episode or in a subsequent episode, I will look at different kinds of cricket captains and what their captaincy style has led to in terms of the fates of their teams. And what kind of lessons do we get from leadership from those people? There are enough reasons, but again, most of us in a corporate environment, we don't really deal with political parties because ultimately a corporate environment is one of meritocracy. I mean, you make money, you stay in power. It's not a question of making an emotional connection. Politics is in that way little different. No matter what we look at manifestos, nobody really votes on manifestos. Nobody really votes on hate speech. Nobody really votes on cow slaughter or the temple. I mean, temple maybe because it's an emotional issue. But ultimately, the real vote catcher is the personality. It's the personality at the end of the ticket. And by the way, the liberal anti-Modi entrenched the structure that they realize this. They have been trying for years to get this one emotional, this personality that people can gravitate towards to kind of stand there and take Modi on. Last election, it was Arvind Kejriwal. Now, of course, he turned out to be a big disappointment, like Varun Chakravarti or Shivam Dubey. And now they have clutched on to Kanhaiya Kumar. So he's the next guy. So, you find, Kanhaiya Kumar's profound speeches being shared on social media. There's absolutely nothing profound in what he's saying. He has this style of talking, this Lalu Yadav style of talking, which is exactly, it's fun. It's definitely fun. But there's absolutely nothing profound that he's talking about. But it's just that the anti-Modi, and of course, they're extremely powerful because they're in the media, because they control the communication that you hear on television and in some cases online. Is that they want you to feel emotional about somebody else. They know that in order to get you off the drug that is Narendra Modi, the personality drug that is Narendra Modi, they need to give you an alternate fix. Unfortunately, Kejriwal is not that fix. He's basically sugar water. And so now they're looking for Kanhaiya Kumar. If Kanhaiya Kumar doesn't succeed, then they'll, in a few years, they'll look for somebody else. So the search for personalities goes on, and everybody understands that ultimately it's one personality against another personality. And I don't know how this election is going to go, but ultimately it's going to be a vote. It's going to be a national vote on the personality of Narendra Modi. That is what exactly is going to be. It's not going to be about issues. It's not going to be about governance. It's going to be about emotion. That's why the BJP's main messaging this time has been much more emotional than cerebral. They're not going for the development kind of thing, which they went last time. Last time it made sense because the Congress had been shambolic in terms of corruption, in terms of performance, in terms of price rise. Normally, a government which exists normally cannot go on development because the question is, if it was development, why didn't you do it last time? So they normally cannot go with that message. That message is purely a prerogative of the opposition. But this time, the BJP's messaging has been to ratchet up the emotion. It has been to ratchet up the presence of Modi, that Modi is the big guy, that it doesn't matter what we have done or what we will do. The Congress has ruled you for 60 years. Believe in Modi. He will do it. Now, how much this will work, we will find out in a few weeks.
All right. Can we go on to a couple of questions? We do have we have a couple of questions, one of which I think you have already answered. So Chintamani was asking about your thoughts on so-called stand-up comedians in India and their political opinions, which I guess you kind of addressed during the podcast today. Anything else you would want to tag on to that?
No, I mean, for instance, I mean, it's so first, you have to understand that everybody has their absolute right to get their political message out. And I have, everybody's political. I'm political also. I'm not a stand-up comic, but I'm political also, definitely. But the thing with stand-up comics who work in a professional sphere, because remember, for me, this is not my profession. I have a 24/7 job that pays my bills. This is just my hobby. But for many of the stand-up comedians, this is not a hobby. This is what they do and what they intend to do for the rest of their lives. And for that, it's very important that they also understand who their audience is. So Indian politics, so Raju Srivastav, for instance, is right wing. Why? Because, you know, the guys who come to listen to him, yeah, that's their profile. So he plays up to them. I don't know what he thinks. I don't know what he believes in, whether he actually believes in what he says, but he does it because that's what his audience wants. And many of these stand-up comics that you're talking about, they do it because the South Mumbai crowd, that is exactly what they believe in. They look down upon BJP as a party of the unwashed, of the guys who want to prevent them from wearing short skirts or from drinking. You know, the killjoys, the old uncles, the antediluvian aunties, or what you... So they represent, and that's really, if you look at their shticks, that's exactly what they're trying to say. They're trying to paint BJP into the stereotype of the person who the South Mumbai crowd considers to be their biggest enemy. So in a way, this is what commerce is. You know, you have a set of customers who are expecting something and you give them that. So I don't think there's anything wrong in that, in the sense that there's nothing wrong. That's really capitalism. But you should always realize that whether how genuine that is as a political opinion, I would rather not go there, because you never know how genuine it is. As in, I don't know how genuine Raju Srivastav's right-wingism is either. So it applies for both sides.
A couple of questions, which unfortunately, apologies to Mayuresh and Srijit, but your questions have been pending for some time, but I guess since they were quite topical, I don't think they make sense anymore. But Kanishka did write in with a question saying, your writing style is well suited for a Netflix type series. I'm not sure what he meant by that. So he's asking you, have you ever thought of, since you are through with books, have you considered writing screenplays?
So the thing about writing screenplays is that, again, it's not something which I am not cinematically trained. The skills that are needed for writing screenplays are very different from the skills that are needed for writing books. You know,
Is it a trainable skill, though?
It is a trainable skill. It's just that I'm not invested. I actually bought a few books and I tried to write a screenplay for Yatrik. And I think I did a rather decent job. But again, I just don't think, you know, I always think that what I've done is a decent job because it's me. But I understand fully that writing screenplay and writing a book are very, very different, because it's very visual medium, right? And a good screenplay is all about expressing things with the minimum amount of dialogue. And a lot of it is an internal, a good screenplay writer. Again, it's not that I can't write a screenplay. I want to write a good screenplay. And a good screenplay is one where the person who's writing the screenplay, in his mind at least, is visualizing where the camera will be placed. Because you see, sometimes dialogue is superfluous if the camera is on the person. Sometimes you don't need to have a page of dialogue if the camera focuses on something else. Maybe just somebody, you know, tapping their finger on the table. See, you know, the kind of thing that Quentin Tarantino in the opening sequence of Inglourious Basterds. See, there's very little dialogue actually. It's all about the camera swinging above the floorboard and below the floorboard. And, you know, there is some dialogue later, but there's a dialogue about milk. So it's a very different skill of writing screenplays. And again, I don't think that I have that skill. Or let's say I think that my time is better spent in doing things which I believe I understand a little bit more than writing screenplays.
Okay, I'm sure that will leave a few people a little disappointed. I guess, is that a wrap for today?
Yes, that is a wrap for today. And please do keep sending in your questions. And I will, I just love to answer your questions. And we will revisit this leadership issue maybe in the next episode or in a subsequent one, where we will focus on the leadership styles of Sachin Tendulkar, Virat Kohli, and principally on Sachin Tendulkar, Virat Kohli, Dhoni, and Sourav Ganguly, and how different they are as leaders, and how that has been reflected in the way their team performs.
Okay, so that's pretty much our podcast for today. We hope you liked it, and you can write in to us at appodcast@talkingstuff.net. And many of you are sending in your questions through WhatsApp, which is great. So our WhatsApp number is 9652578833. That's 9652578833. And feel free to send in your questions as a message or even as a voice message, as many of you have been doing. So see you next time around. Thanks and bye-bye.